there was a tremendous flowering of mutual aid. And I thought this was one of the most critical developments on the U.S. side, because what it really pointed to was social solidarity isn't dead.
Kale Akuno of Cooperation Jackson says that grassroots organizers should systematically build on the outpouring of mutual aid in the response to the coronavirus crisis.
As this country unravels, the central government is going to be unable to control the states. States are going to be unable to control completely the cities.
Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace warns that poor and working people must organize mutual aid to survive as institutional chaos increases.
I've risked my life by reporting officers. I've received death threats from officers. Officers liking the idea of me bleeding out on a call by myself.
A retired homicide detective from St. Louis, Missouri, testifies to Congress about white supremacists working in law enforcement.
Cuba is not about trying to train doctors that are going to become specialists and make all kinds of money. It's about being really rooted in the community and dealing with people and putting people's health first.
And we'll hear about how Cuba has effectively battled the coronavirus. This and more in today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. We had planned to start today by speaking to Kale Akuno of Cooperation Jackson, an emerging cooperative network based in Jackson, Mississippi. But he's had to deal with urgencies there, so we're going to play some of his remarks at a September online forum titled Building a Transatlantic Strategy: What Have We Learned from the Last 5 Years? The event brought together organizers in the U.S. and U.K. to discuss their involvement in the failed campaigns to elect Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. Central themes were the energy that electoral politics had drained from the social movements, the need to build institutions independent of existing power structures, the role of unions, and the need for political education. Here's Kale Akuno.
Here in the United States, there was a tremendous flowering of mutual aid work that just took off in March, April, May. And I thought this was one of the most critical developments on the U.S. side, really in about 20 years, if not even longer. Because what it really pointed to was social solidarity isn't dead. Despite neoliberalism, which I see as a deep reactionary cultural project, this spoke that people still had it within themselves to seek each other out and to support each other in critical times of need. And that is something that we have to build upon, I think, in a systematic way. The some of the things that we've been trying to identify around the building fight, we're saying that it really has to start with this mutual aid work, because that is concretely, at least, that is where literally millions of people are at. And in the foreseeable future, with so many millions of people in the United States being unemployed, it's where we're going to have to go in a critical way in our organizing model to be able to meet many folks' basic needs. And you can see the ongoing continuation of that need in the just any major food giveaway that happens now in the United States in any major city. There are lines around the block that happens here in my community and almost everyone that I see. And there are layers of working class people that are there, and they are not being, for the most part, engaged in any sustained political dialogue or conversation, and they absolutely should be. We need to be having real conversations ascertaining how people are seeing this moment, you know, what are their needs outside of the food needs, because you know if you have a food need, there's usually a medical need, there's a housing need, there's et cetera, and then start having conversation that we can enable folks to take this active role in helping us, in us helping ourselves, to move forward towards the productive end of that, not just the receiving end of that. And that is where, you know, I think the work that's happening in a lot of different communities where there's already, you know, a ton of community gardens or connections, I think the folks are being tied into some of the suburban and rural farms, particularly here in the United States, and then the work of the solidarity economy and all the co-ops have been emerging. We need to be politicizing that work, and it starts with being in concrete dialogue around meeting people's objective needs. So in the United States, I can tell you, like in a place like Mississippi, the little things that we've been able to do, which hasn't been to scale because of COVID-19 to the degree that we wanted to, but we've been able to reach, you know, just through some of our basic work in this arena, to reach many white forces who we've been able to move off of some right-leaning orientation just from basic human contact and sustained conversation. And the fact that the fascists are not the only people talking to them is of major critical importance and could be of some critical life and death in our environment in the weeks and days ahead. So I just want to outline that. And that's the other piece, really, where and how municipalities can get involved, that really depends on the strength of the social movements that's in your area. You got to put that first, I would argue, rather than necessarily what the municipality can do. And I'm saying that because if there isn't a strong movement, and we've learned this here in Jackson, when our movement is weak, the state government can come in and just slap all kinds of restrictions on us. When the movement is strong, they still try to do that, but there's a fight back and there's a push, and we find creative ways to get around the restrictions the federal or the state government, in our case, tries to impose upon us meeting direct needs. And then once we have that, policy creativity flows very easily. You know, without it, people tend to stick, well, I can only do it this way, or this is what the book says, as opposed to, you know, in our case, where there's some things, that remarkable things that have happened, in my view, on a municipal level in the context of COVID-19, is the city has found a number of different ways to make public spaces available, and be they police stations or the fire stations, that enable civil society groups to come in and do some of the work that the state has prohibited them from doing. So they can say, you can't deliver masks, which is something they did here in Mississippi, because the government, the municipal government, Chokwe Antar's government, was giving out some masks, and they tried to ban that. So we can get around that by saying, okay, we can just make the space available and allow the civil society groups, quote unquote, to come in and do that same work. That's the way we've been able to kind of reach scale, but it's because of the growing strength of the social movement kind of being back on the rise here. And I just want to put that out so folks clearly understand, like, where I think at this juncture of the road, our side of the equation needs to be centering its focus, energy, and attention.
That was Kali Okuno of the Jackson, Mississippi-based cooperative movement, Cooperation Jackson. He is also a member of the Black Alliance for Peace, which calls for closure of the U.S. Empire of military bases and the end of its division of the world into geographic and strategic commands. Last week, the Black Alliance for Peace held an International Day of Action to shut down AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. Ajamu Baraka, founding member of the Black Alliance for Peace, spoke about it to Davey D of Pacifica's Hard Knock Radio. Here's part of that conversation.
It is what we call in the Black Alliance for Peace the pan-European colonial capitalist white supremacist project. We name the enemy. We say that we can't have freedom of African people in the U.S. or African people on the continent unless we understand the nature of this pan-European colonial capitalist project. And we name that enemy. So yes, no, it's the same interest. And look, the way they operate through the neocolonial leadership on the African continent is the same way that the white capitalist power operates, working through the neocolonial leadership of black folks in these Democrat-controlled cities in the U.S. You know, this is how they operate, through neocolonial puppet leadership. We say that we are a colonized people in the U.S., and we have our colonial overseers in these various cities, these Democrat-led cities. That's why when the people rose up in Baltimore, for example, unlike Ferguson, the entire Negro class came out in opposition, led by Barack Obama, who condemned the resistors as criminals, as thugs, in language very similar to how Donald Trump characterized the resistors. So these folks are upholding the interests of the state, the interests of white colonial capitalist power. And we've got to understand it and can't play with this issue any longer of class. I love all black folks. No, I don't love all black folks. There's some black folks that are basically the enemy, and that's how they have to be dealt with.
Boy, there's a lot there. Is there a path to victory here? And by that, are there organization, are there groups of people that you all identify and say, this is how we put our support? Are there opposition movements that we need to be aware of? What are the names of those opposition movements? So how do we start to unravel this sordid legacy of AFRICOM? You know, what's our path? Who do we uplift in this struggle?
We have to build organization. And one of the things that we're doing is to build the organizational capacity to deal with those challenges you just identified. We're linking up with African organizations on the African continent. We have a U.S. out of Africa network that's made up now over 251 individuals, organizations from across the Americas, the Caribbean, Europe, and on the African continent. It's only through struggle and building the capacity to, in fact, engage in struggle that we can, in fact, have a path toward victory. Look, that basically we understand that until we are able to defeat the pan-European colonial capitalist project, we're not going to have freedom not only for African people, but for the entire world. Because the contradiction now, Davey, is not just between, you know, workers and capitalists any longer. The contradiction is between the pan-European colonial capitalist project and the rest of humanity. The 10% of U.S. and European humanity that are struggling ferociously to maintain their hegemony against the rest of us. If we don't take power from these folks, we won't be able to survive. Look at what happened with this pandemic. The commercial capitalist interests predominated over global cooperation. They saw a way of making some money. Now, if we see the same things happening with this pandemic, what do people think is going to happen with this major challenge we have with global climate change?
How do people survive what may actually come to pass here?
Yes.
Where protest and resistance, even organizing, is heavily criminalized and heavily punished. And I've been to places where that is taking place. I've been to Lebanon and some of these other countries where I've been at conferences and met people who was like, I've been in jail for 15 years. Why? Because I spoke out. I didn't throw a rock. I didn't set a fire. I spoke out against the government. And we now see this totalitarianism expanding all over where they're like, hey, Black Alliance for Peace is on the same level as Antifa, is on the same level as the Klan, their terrorist organization. Let us heavily punish them. And so even having conversations could, you know, be criminalized. And we know that happens in other countries. So from the work that you're doing, how are they surviving that sort of repression? And what should we be prepared for where what we take for granted could all of a sudden put us in crosshairs in ways that we haven't imagined?
That's a very good question. And we answer by saying, first, we remind ourselves we have political prisoners in this country who have been locked down now, some of them for 50 years. So we understand the role of the state. We remember and we know what happened with COINTELPRO, and we know what's happening today. So, you know, it's natural that the state will respond with repression. That's what I was saying earlier, that they can no longer pretend that they are going to follow democratic norms, respect people's fundamental human rights. They are in a struggle to maintain their power. Therefore, that's why they are criminalizing opposition. So the same ways we survive here, same ways other movements have survived and prospered, that's what we have to do. The key, David, is organization, is having a vision of where we need to go. It is building structure with discipline. And that's how we survive and we prosper. We have to build independent organizations with the ability to not only engage in direct political work, but to provide the material needs of our people. You know, we've got to eat. We've got to have shelter. And that's why sometimes, you know, looking at how we can maybe take some of those spots on the local level in terms of the state becomes important, okay? Because as this country unravels, the central government is going to be unable to control the states. States are going to be unable to control completely the cities. We have to be prepared to be able to survive and protect ourselves, to have some degree of ability for self-defense, because it's going to get completely insane. It's going to get worse before it gets better, but it will get better. But we have to be prepared for that. We are in an urgent situation now, Dave. We've got to get organized, and we can no longer play with any illusions about reforming this thing.
That was Ajamu Baraka, founding member of the Black Alliance for Peace, speaking with Davey D on Hard Knock Radio. Stay with us. Racist attacks on Muslims and immigrants, public racist display, and racist police brutality have all escalated during Donald Trump's presidency. Many are now asking about the extent to which U.S. police departments, most of whose unions support Donald Trump, have been infiltrated by white supremacists.
On the ground show.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Ivarum. Well, on September 29, 2020, the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties hosted a remote hearing on white supremacists infiltrating police departments.
In 2006, the FBI released an intelligence assessment warning of, quote, white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement.
Chairman of the subcommittee, Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland.
The FBI identified two distinct problems. First, the FBI noted the problem of white supremacist groups infiltrating law enforcement. The FBI also identified a second problem, law enforcement officers who have no formal affiliation with racist groups, but who sympathize with their racist ideology. In 2019, a team of investigative journalists published the Plainview Project, which collected over 5,000 postings displaying white supremacist, xenophobic, misogynistic, and violent Facebook material from police officers in 8 different cities.
Check out these social media posts. It's a good day for a chokehold.
Another night to wrangle up these zoo animals in reference to Detroit residents.
Or hope that this piece of S is dealt with by street justice or just plain karma quickly, hopefully by police gunfire. Or F these Muslim.
Officer Kevin Piner is heard telling Corporal Jesse Moore that the protests would soon lead to a civil war and that he is ready. He goes on to tell Moore that he was going to buy a new assault rifle and soon we are just going to go out and start slaughtering them expletive N-words. Piner says a civil war is needed to wipe them off the expletive map. That'll put them back about 4 or 5 generations.
We invited the FBI to come today. The Bureau refused to come, claiming it has nothing to say because they have no evidence that this is a widespread problem demanding the FBI's attention. What's more, they've attempted to disavow their own 2006 intelligence assessment, which has every sign of being an authentic document. They did provide us an unredacted version of that 2006 assessment. The redacted passages include prescient warnings for the American people. The FBI warned that, quote, white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement can result in abuses of authority and passive tolerance of racism within communities served. The FBI also cautioned that police officers who are hostile to civil rights might, quote, volunteer their professional resources to the white supremacist causes with which they sympathize. These are chilling conclusions. But rather than clearly spell out this threat for the American people, the FBI has suppressed them from public view for 14 years. For the first time, we can now see that the FBI believed internally that white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement departments was a serious problem.
Retired homicide detective from St. Louis, Heather Taylor.
I want to provide my perspective by telling a true story. For nearly 7 years, I have repeatedly reported an officer for his racism. I learned this officer had a penchant for making racist statements about Black people on social media. These statements were not the worst of his actions. This officer and other officers killed a Black man under questionable circumstances in 2012. I was a scene investigator on that case. That case haunts me to this day. He used a banned chokehold. Another officer tased this man 6 times. 6 times. The officer violated numerous policies. A witness said that one of the officers used the N-word during this incident. Others stated the victim resisted arrest. The use of the N-word, all witness statements relayed to me, all questionable actions by the officers were placed in a police report, an official document. The report was turned over to the Internal Affairs Division for review for criminal charges or discipline. I was told the officers would return to full duty. I believe more extensive background checks are necessary with hiring. I believe immediate termination and removal of police certifications of officers that support white supremacy, that are corrupt in any way, that these officers should be removed immediately. And it is clear in anyone saying that you can train away racism, they're wrong. You cannot train away racism. You need to weed it out. You need to fire them and terminate them if they're officers. I also believe that whistleblower protections need to become a priority. I've risked my life by reporting officers. I've received death threats from officers, officers liking the idea of me bleeding out on a call by myself. It's impossible to break the blue code of silence if there are no protections in place that empowers officers to come forward. I would also like to state that COVID-19 is the leading cause of death for police officers and suicide. The leading cause of death. We are losing officers by COVID-19 and suicide. We have had 45 officers this year, unfortunately, including Officer Tamaris Bohannon, who was shot and killed, that have been shot and killed or died by force, use of force. I think it's important to address that sympathizing with white supremacy is a problem within our law enforcement communities. That is a reality. And what we see with the officer that I'm speaking about in my example is that he is a field training officer. He's training other officers to become officers. There's no way that he should have been allowed to continue in this field. I would also like to add in this that there was a recent study by the Citigroup that listed that $16 trillion is a result of racism in our country. $16 trillion. That's what we have as a result of racism in our country. And that includes law enforcement and the settlements that have been made regarding racist officers and sympathizers within our police department.
Damning testimony at the most recent congressional hearing on white supremacists in the nation's public institutions. OnTheGroundShow.org. Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Evarim.
The alleged infiltration of white supremacist groups in law enforcement is nothing new. In fact, in the early 1900s, while thousands of KKK members marched in full attire in the streets of Washington, D.C. and Anaheim, California, the Klan bragged about its presence in law enforcement. And in March of 1991, amidst the L.A. uprising in reaction to the police beating of Rodney King, Los Angeles police officer Jeanine Bouie, in a press conference, denounced KKK presence inside the LAPD. After her heroic actions, Officer Bouie, like Officer Taylor, whom we heard from just now, received numerous death threats. In an interview with the New York Times, Officer Bouie said that she had been harassed by white officers who left her a KKK calling card that read, quote, "Racial purity is America's security."
One people, one nation, and immigration!
We're honoring the founding fathers who were white.
Stay with us.
Pobre del cantor de nuestros días, que no arriesgue su cuerda por no arriesgar su vida. Pobre del cantor que nunca sepa que fuimos la semilla y hoy somos esta vida. Pobre del cantor que un día la historia lo borré sin la gloria de haber tocado espinas. Pobre del cantor que fue marcado para sufrir un poco y hoy está derrotado. Pobre del cantor que sus informes le borren hasta el nombre con copias asesinas. Pobre del cantor que no se alce y siga hacia adelante con más canto y más vida. pobre del cantor que no hay el modo de tener bien seguro su proceder con todos. Pobre del cantor que no se imponga con su canción de gloria con embarres y lodo.
We just heard Pobre del Cantor by Cuban musician Pablo Milanés. October 9 marks 53 years since Che Guevara was executed by the U.S.-backed Bolivian army. But today, Che's legacy as a revolutionary and medical doctor lives on. The death rate from COVID-19 is more than 60 times higher in the U.S. than in Cuba. The country has effectively battled the coronavirus through its exemplary public health system and its international medical partnerships. Next up, Pacifica's Ken Yale speaks with Don Fitz about how Che's vision helped shape the Cuban medical system and about responses to COVID-19 in Cuba that are fundamentally different than those in the U.S.
You published an article entitled How Che Guevara Taught Cuba to Confront COVID-19, but Che died in 1967. So what did you mean by that?
Well, of course, Che Guevara had no idea that COVID-19 would ever happen. But what he did know was how to completely revolutionize medicine. When he was a young man, he took time out of medical school to go visit a leper colony in Peru. It was an event that totally changed his life. He felt it was absolutely necessary to live with the people and understand the people that you're helping. He was critical in initiating for the Cuban Revolution what we would call 60 years later, Medicare for All. The first goal of the revolution was to establish medical care throughout Cuba to everybody. Cuba established the rural medical service and required that all graduates of medical school work for 2 years in the rural areas. Che inspired a whole generation of doctors to do this. What Che did was to help develop the idea that physicians should be helping people and not just making money. And Che understood the need to totally change the medical system. The changes kept on going through Cuba for 60 years, and it was able to respond to COVID-19 much better than the United States was.
According to Johns Hopkins, the U.S. death rate from COVID-19 is more than 60 times higher than Cuba's. How has Cuba responded to the coronavirus and done so much to protect the health and well-being of their people?
They immediately cut down on tourism, which was extremely difficult for Cuba because tourism is a major source of income for Cuba. But despite that, they cut down. They required people to wear masks. They did contact tracing when there were just a few people who had COVID-19 in Cuba. They looked at hotspots in Cuba where there was a lot of COVID-19. And where there was, they restricted travel in and out of these areas. They did something in hospitals, which I have never heard of being done in other countries. Cuban doctors actually were quarantined for 45-day stretches at a time before they could go back. In the urban areas, every physician can visit a home by walking to it because there's that many. There's one doctor in the neighborhood for every 1,500 or so residents. In the rural areas, the doctors will travel by bicycle or donkey or horse in order to reach everybody in the community. If it's really low populated, they might get a car, but those are really lucky physicians. In the U.S., if you think you have symptoms of COVID-19, you have to contact the medical establishment, whether it's a doctor's office, a clinic, or whatever. It's the responsibility of the patient to do that. In Cuba, it's the opposite direction. The medical staff and the medical students go out to every neighborhood in the country, whether city or rural, and check on every single person and see what they need. Do they have symptoms of COVID-19? Do they need to be checked out by a physician or hospital more thoroughly? Does a person not have enough food because they can't get out of the house because they're quarantined? Whatever the problems people have, the doctor's office works with the other community organizations to make sure that every single person is taken care of in connection with COVID-19 and people are not left uncared for. The other thing which is totally different about Cuban medicine is that every part of it's integrated. In the United States, there's 50 sets of rules. Each state has its own rules. People can follow them or not, and sometimes they just totally ignore them. In Cuba, that's not at all the case. There's one protocol which was developed by the Ministry of Health that applies to urban areas to rural areas, and they'll have regular meetings between physicians and clinic doctors, and they will be talking about, are there high rates of COVID-19? What sort of problems do people have? Do the medical students have stress? Do the doctors and nurses, do they have stress? And each clinic then reports that to the national organization, and the national organization modifies the policies. So that, in a sense, every single person in Cuba has a part in developing the COVID policy, because the COVID policy comes from the clinics, which comes from the doctors, which comes from the patients. So you have a thoroughly integrated system where they can respond to COVID-19 very rapidly.
The U.S. has blamed China for the virus, undermined the World Health Organization, privatized vaccine development, and competed internationally for supplies rather than collaborating with other nations. How does that compare to Cuba's approach to the global community?
Well, you got to keep in mind that Cuba has been having international medical missions since the first days of the revolution. Since the revolution, Cuba has had over 400,000 medical staff serve overseas in some capacity. And Cuba has brought tens of thousands of people from overseas into Cuba. And so during COVID-19, when Cuba started to help other people, this was a continuation of what had gone on for decades. It wasn't anything new. After the Chernobyl disaster of 1986, Cuba took in 20,000 people from Chernobyl to treat them for radiation sickness. Almost all of them were children. There has been at least one doctor who's died during COVID-19 as a result of catching COVID from going to another country. And this sort of goes back to Che. Che and Fidel both emphasized right after the revolution that it was, they called it a sacred duty of doctors to provide health for people. And when Ebola hit Africa, other countries sent money. Cuba sent doctors. Cuba has a culture that it's the responsibility of doctors to help people.
What is an important lesson that the world can learn from Cuba's approach to COVID-19?
We're all in one world. If a pandemic strikes one part of the world, the chances are very likely that it's going to hit other parts of the world. You can see that inside the United States. If low-income people are not cared for, and as a result of that, get COVID-19 because of the conditions in which people live, everybody is exposed more. Now everybody travels around the world all the time. So if we do not help other countries, then we are putting ourselves at risk. Selfishness is a very, very bad idea when it comes to medical care.
Don Fitz, appreciations for your insights and inspiration. A few final thoughts. What does it say when Cuba can offer the world an effective model for containing a global pandemic with just a fraction of the resources of the United States, but a priority on the health of every human being? What does it say that Cuba has accomplished this despite 60 years of blockades, sanctions, and ruthless U.S. attacks? Perhaps if the U.S. empire wasn't working so hard to undermine the Cuban Revolution, it might learn some things from Che and the Cuban people that could save millions of lives.
That was Pacifica's Ken Yale speaking to activist, teacher, psychologist, and prolific author Don Fitz. His book, Cuban Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution, was recently published by Monthly Review. Cuba is the only country in the world to export great numbers of medics to do solidarity work, especially in impoverished areas of the world. Their internationalist medical work has now been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. The nation also has a university that trains doctors from different countries to return to their own communities to work as community physicians. Lawrence Reyes spoke to Gail Walker, Executive Director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, about their work with Cuba.
Over the last couple decades, we've had the distinct honor to be able to be the entity in the United States that helps to recruit and recommend candidates to Cuba, to our friends in Cuba, to attend medical school at ELAM, the Latin America School of Medicine. That's the English translation of the acronym, under full scholarship, with the only understanding being that they will return back to their home communities and serve in underserved communities. And it's a full ride for primarily young people of color from the inner cities, from rural areas, from different parts of the United States that we're responsible for. Of course, due to the vision of Comandante Fidel Castro to take a naval barracks and convert it into an internationally renowned medical training facility, tens of thousands of young people from more than 125 nations, including the United States, have graduated from Elam and are now practicing medicine in underserved communities across the country, across the world, across the globe. The role that we play is to identify candidates, recommend them to our Cuban counterparts at Elam. They make the final decision. It's their program. We're just pleased to be able to play this role of identifying young people who are have the vision and desire to become doctors, but just can't afford the, you know, whatever, $250,000, $300,000 to go to medical school here. But also, Lawrence, it's really important to note that the training that they're getting as Cuban-trained doctors is a gift in itself. You know, Cuba is not about trying to train doctors that are going to become specialists and make all kinds of money. It's about being really rooted in the community and dealing with people and putting people's health first. Community medicine. And so that's the training that these young people receive. And it's been a real gift, a gift to them, but also a gift to the communities that they return home to serve in. Just a quick story. One young woman who had graduated and prior to graduation had actually gone down to Haiti when the earthquake had hit Port-au-Prince in 2010. And she talked about how they were prepared because they had emergency preparedness courses throughout their studies. And so when they hit the ground, they were prepared to make a triage center, to build a hospital in a park and where they saw patients from, you know, sun up to sundown, vis-a-vis some U.S. doctors that arrived. And they arrived, you know, of course, I have to use the voice of, where's the hospital? They were there ready to serve. Where's the hospital? And people were like, man, there's an earthquake. There is no infrastructure. This is the kind of training that these Cuban docs had allowed them to be prepared to really truly give back. It's a tremendous gift all around.
That was Gail Walker of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization speaking with Pacifica's Lawrence Reyes.
This is part of a conversation that aired on the show From Decolonization to Liberation on RadioJustice.org.
This year's Grassroots Radio Conference will be held online next Friday to Sunday, October 9 to 11. The annual event is typically hosted by a Pacifica Radio affiliate station, most recently by KUHS Hot Springs, Arkansas in 2016, WCAA Albany, New York in 2017, KBOO Portland, Oregon in 2018, and three low-power FM stations, WXIR, WAYO, and WEPL in Rochester, New York, in 2019. Coronavirus forced this year's conference to go virtual, but it will still be hosted, as planned, by WXOX Louisville, Kentucky. WXOX broadcasts to the community still rising up in response to Louisville police killing emergency medical technician Breonna Taylor and Kentucky National Guard killing barbecue chef David McAtee, both of whom were Black. I spoke to WXOX General Manager Sharon Scott.
Sharon Scott, we want to talk about the conference and how BLM and the uprising around Breonna Taylor and David McAtee's killing has affected WXOX. But first, tell us why WXOX identifies as an art station rather than a standard music or public affairs station.
So the name of our radio station is Art FM. And we're broadcasting on WXOX 97.1 FM in Louisville. And the concept behind our station is approaching radio as its own art form, not just a form that carries other art forms. Thinking about what does it mean to communicate with so many people at once? What are different things we can do with this medium? How can we approach things a little more creatively than they have been before in radio?
Yeah, I've noticed when I listen, I can tell it's an experimental medium. It's very interesting.
Yes. It's different all the time. Every time you turn it on, you'll get a totally different situation. And that's what's exciting and fun about it.
So how, since you don't have standard public affairs reporting or newscasts except for Democracy Now!, how has the uprising, the BLM uprising around Breonna and David McAtee made its way into the station?
It's been very different than your typical newscasting. What you're hearing on Art FM is people responding with their hearts and with their music and with their poetry to what's going on. And the radio programs have been extremely moving. They've been very informative. We've been letting people know what's going on, but not in your typical news sense. More wrapped up with arts and culture and history, and certainly taking a more expressive, maybe a bit more of an emotional approach to the situation.
Have you had reports coming in from the streets?
Yeah, we have. We have a number of DJs that have been going out into the field, recording what's happening. One of them ended up in the hospital last week. He's thankfully okay. But they've really been getting out there and getting the sounds of this community right now.
Would you say that the station has been a locus for BLM organizers and the community?
I think so. I think about us as something of the soundtrack. If you think of the Warriors movie or something, the voices that are coming out inspiring the leaders of this movement, inspiring people to stand up for what they believe in. We're doing our thing, and that is what we consider our role in this situation. Just keeping it live, keeping it happening, keeping people ready to fight for what they believe in.
Okay, tell us about the workshop that you'll be giving on Saturday afternoon.
Our workshop will be called Live and Loud. It is a session on taking community radio stations remote. As the coronavirus spread around the world, we realized we may have to take our radio station remote. We may have to let our DJs broadcast from home, but we wanted to make sure they stayed live and it didn't become them recording shows and sending them into the station. It's very important for us to be live on the air, happening right now in the moment. And we figured out a great system that's very inexpensive and fairly simple, and we can teach people how to do it in about an hour's time. And one of the reasons we really wanted to host this conference is so we could share with everyone this technique that we've used to get all of our 120 DJs broadcasting from home in hopes that other stations can get live back on the air during this pandemic. And I would just want to encourage anyone, even if they're not directly involved in radio, this conference could be interesting for so many people. Chuck D will be a keynote speaker on Friday night. We've got Will Oldham and John Langford of the Mekons. So we had some great musical acts as well as some really brilliant radio minds coming together this weekend.
And that was Sharon Scott, General Manager of Pacifica Radio Affiliate WXOX 97.1 FM Louisville, host of this year's virtual grassroots radio conference beginning online on Friday. Conference workshops include Radio as Resistance, Hyperlocal News Reporting During Emergencies, Making Radio with Phones and Computers, and Riot for Radio. Hip-hop star Chuck D has agreed to interrupt the promotional tour for his new album to give the Friday evening keynote address, Radio and the Justice Movement.
Playback!
And we just heard Chuck D of Public Enemy with the iconic original 1989 track, Fight the Power. Thousands of Alameda County, California health system workers are fighting for PPE, staffing, and against outsourcing and union busting by their public health care system. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer brings us the details.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. Healthcare workers have faced the brunt of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our last show covered the strike action in Chicago of healthcare workers. This coming week, thousands of healthcare workers will be striking the Alameda Health System, AHS, in the Bay Area's East Bay. These workers have faced a lack of masks, PPE, and outsourcing and union busting by the management, which was put in place by the Alameda Board of Supervisors. We interviewed two SEIU 1021 workers, Nurse Keda Kabah, who is chapter treasurer, and Salika Carter, a community healthcare worker and chapter secretary, about their upcoming strike action October 7th this month. So, Keda, why don't you talk about what's been going on at AHS and why you and your fellow brothers and sisters in the union are going to be having a major strike of that system?
I work for Alameda Health System. I actually work for John George Psychiatric Hospital. I think COVID has amplified all of the deficiencies that we have been shouting about for years. And we're talking about misallocation of resources, chronic understaffing, just not treating our patients as good as patients in other parts of the Bay Area have been treated. So it'll start with, so let's talk about the chronic understaffing. Instead of hiring sufficient people, they continue to hire contract workers from temp agencies. They also fired many, many, many environmental service workers. Who can have a hospital without environmental service workers? So now we see months later during the COVID how important it is to have these people. But they fire them all. They have inadequate staffing in the nutrition, food and nutrition department. I could just go on and on and on. So then we have COVID and everything is amplified. So now we talk about the shortage of PPE. And then from my perspective, I'm a registered nurse, but I work more in the finance department. We see, have you heard of the homeless bill, the SB 1152?
Yes.
So among the many provisions of the homeless bill is to ensure that patients upon discharge or prior to discharge have been offered the opportunity to sign up for our state-sponsored Medicaid, which we call Medi-Cal. But in order to do that, you actually have to have staff to go to the patient and help them do that. And they have been horribly understaffed. So then we have patients going into the community who may not be able to get follow-up care because we did not have the staff to reach out to them to help them apply for Medi-Cal, which is part of this this bill.
Shalika, why don't you talk about some of the issues that you faced this last year and the conditions that you feel have to be addressed and the reason you're taking this strike action?
Moving toward a more privatized sort of system, which we know when you're dealing with a community that we deal with that most of the patients don't have any types of insurance and they still need the care, but they don't have insurance. Private industry is not going to help or fix that problem. So just leadership at AHS having no clue as to how to address the issues either with their staffing or the structure and or their patient population. Not really caring about those black and brown communities and realizing that those black and brown communities are the communities that they're serving and just unfortunately so happen to be at a disadvantage and disenfranchised and they can't afford health care, but that doesn't mean that they don't need it.
The Alameda Board of Supervisors, I mean, it seems like they've allowed this company also to engage in massive outsourcing, contracting out that threatens the workers and the public. How is that harmed the protection of the patients and the workers at the health system?
Well, you have private interest. You have a lot of nepotism happening. You have big corporate backing. And so what you have are a bunch of suits sitting around making decisions on health care and health systems, not providers, not people who provide the public safety or provide the care. And this is a health care system. This is not a boardroom. This is not private corporate company. So it's a problem because you can't have a structure that's addressed, that has a different model or goal in mind in terms of what they need to address for a health care system. You need health care, you need professionals and people that are equipped to address those healthcare issues, whether it be with staffing and understanding the plight of the employee because they understand what the employee is going through within the healthcare system. If you have a corporate entrance, all you're talking about is money and spending, and that's not what it's about. It's about care and need, and then the companies that want to privatize, and that's what their interest is, you lose sight of what the interest of the public is.
The issue of Cal/OSHA, which is the agency in California responsible for protection of the health and safety of California's 18 million workers, have you made an effort to get them to protect the health and safety of the workers and the patients, particularly the workers at AHS? And what has been the response of Governor Newsom's Cal/OSHA?
We've written letters, we've called, and we've done complaints. No, I have yet to see it. But what I have seen happen with Alameda Health System, that there is retaliation happening against the employees when they're reporting to these agencies. Injury to one is injury to all. I always say that. Injury to a healthcare worker is an injury to the community. Injury to a system of healthcare and promoting our systemic racism throughout is an injury and it's a systemic problem all over. And it goes to show that in private interest, a lot of the time, trumps democratic process and policy. And unfortunately, you know, it's going to take us as voters to never forget this and to remember what happened during this pandemic and who addressed it and who didn't.
And finally, we hear an explosive leaked phone call that exposes Russia's Vladimir Putin's hand in poisonings, chemical attacks, and Taliban bounties. Compliments of the investigators and comedians at the Gray Zone.
Mr. President, what I can do you for?
Admiral, we have big problem and need immediate operation. Alexei Navalny, you know?
Yes, sir.
There is new poll out. His party was at 1%. Now his party is at 2%. I won last presidential election by only 76 points. We must eliminate new existential threat to my political survival.
Yes, sir. So how to proceed?
After massive success of Skripal poison operation, perfectly timed ahead of World Cup in Russia, in middle of my global charm offensive to make whole of Europe hate Russia, we must immediately go back to same playbook.
Brilliant idea, sir.
Yes, Admiral. We will deploy chemical weapon that only Soviet Union has manufactured and make sure is so deadly it failed to kill Skripal and daughter and both made full recovery and disappeared in British witness protection.
Very intelligent idea, sir. We must break him.
Da. So we poison Navalny in crowded airport with Novichok, which, according to chemical expert, will kill everyone in immediate vicinity. But like with Skripal, this Novichok will somehow kill no one. It instead will make Navalny go into coma. Then, when international community go crazy and demand custody of Mr. 2% Navalny, we agree to send him to Germany.
Germany is great potential economic partner in Nord Stream pipeline.
Exactamente, Admiral. If we poison Navalny and make sure he go to Germany, we successfully disrupt our chances of securing vital natural gas pipeline deal with Germany that is critical to Russian national security and economic future.
Sir, you are genius. You play three-dimension chess better than the warmongering grifter. What's his name?
I think you mean Garry Kasparov.
Da. I am at your service, Mr. President. Спасибо.
That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Fan Garrison. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.